You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The immigrant experience is the story of America, and America is the story of its immigrants. The struggles of Irish, Italian, Eastern European, and Mexicans who came to this country have been documented in historical accounts, works of fiction, and film, and have been a basic part of our social fabric. Yet there's little documentation or celebration of the emigres from the Arab world. In her book, A Country Called America, U.S. History Retold Through Arab American Lives, Alia Malik takes a historical look at Arab immigration to the United States through the eyes of 11 Arab Americans. Ms. Malik is a journalist and a civil rights lawyer who's worked in the U.S. Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division in Lebanon and in the West Bank. Her book, which has just been released in a paperback edition by the Free Press, brings Alia Malik to our show today. Hi.
Hi, Leonard. Thanks for having me.
Is America the Arab word for America?
It's the formal Arabic word for America.
The formal one. Mm-hmm. I thought it was just a mispronunciation.
Not at all.
Really? Now, where would obviously it was an invented word at some point.
Well, when I say formal, I mean there are a lot of dialects and there are different ways to sort of pronounce it in the different dialects. But America would be the way you would say it in formal Arabic.
Thinking back to my introduction, why has there been such a dearth of information and stories about the Arab experience in America, even before 9/11?
You know, most people would be surprised to hear that about 90,000 people from the Arabic-speaking world came over before 1924, before immigration to the United States stopped. And you're right. People don't, when we sort of think about the huddled masses that came over at that time and now make up, you know, many of our cities and states in this country, people from the Arabic-speaking world are not part of it. I think a big part of it had to do with the naturalization struggle that they went through here. Before the change in the immigration law in the 1950s, you had to prove in court that you were white to gain American citizenship. And in the case of these emigres, in every single case, the United States government opposed their naturalization on the grounds that they were not white, which didn't happen with Greeks and Italians and other people who had you know, in many ways, their trajectories.
Swarthy skin in some cases.
Exactly. But
some Arabs are whiter than other people in this country, if that is a consideration.
Right. It's not about a phenotypical commonality that binds the Arab-American experience. It's more about how we've sort of constructed the East in the American imagination. And I think that was a part of it. There was a definite, you know, they sort of got in by the skin of their own teeth as American citizens. And I think that sent a strong signal to sort of minimize their ethnicity.
Well, in the American imagination, all Arabs are Muslims too.
Right.
But they're not all Muslims.
No. Most Arab Americans are actually Christian. I think that probably comes as a surprise to most folks. But also in the Arab world, you have all kinds of other religious minorities and sects within the religions, not just different religions.
Like other groups, there have been waves of immigration of Arabs. Have they usually been spurred by events in the emigres' home countries?
Well, of course, in the period from the late 1800s to the early 1920s, when immigration to the United States sort of came to a halt from that part of the world, what you saw was a lot of Jewish and Christian Arabs leave.
Because of repression?
Well, actually, because up until a certain point of time, they were all living under the Ottoman Empire at the time, and Christians and Jews were sort of exempted from conscription into the Ottoman army. And at that time, when they lifted the conscription, that was, you know, sort of a great impetus to leave. There's also starvation, and there was a famine in the late 1800s.
We know about the Armenians who were forced to leave, but were there similar things happening with Arabs? Because the Ottoman Empire is a Muslim country. It was a Muslim empire, mm-hmm. but it wasn't an Arab empire.
Well, the Armenians were living in sort of what is modern-day Turkey. But in the case of where the Ottoman Empire was in what is modern-day Syria, Lebanon, Palestine, and Israel, the Christians and the Jews that were living there, that was their, that's where they were from. So it was it would have been harder to enforce something like that.
How did you find and choose the people that you've profiled here?
Well, I mean, I sort of did casting calls. You know, I had ideas for certain of the chapters, I knew what kind of people I wanted. I knew that the book had to open in Birmingham, Alabama. So I knew I had to find someone down
and
there.
And why Birmingham? And because you do tie this to the the Martin Luther King and the
church. Well, the reason the book opens in Birmingham is because, you know, I wanted to explore the book mostly explores the time in the United States after the 64 Civil Rights Act, the 65 Voting Rights Act, and the Immigration Act of 65, which most people, I mean, I think most people think of the Civil Rights Act and the Voting Rights Act together, but they don't realize that the Immigration Act was sort of part of Lyndon Johnson's trifecta of, you know, equalizing American society through legislation. And I wanted to make it really tangible for people what both America and America were like before those, you know, before those legislative revolutions of sorts. And the reason, you know, the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act were finally able to get passed was because of events in Birmingham. That's why Martin Luther King had gone down to Birmingham in that spring, because he was trying to force Kennedy's hand. And he knew, you know, Bull Connor and the folks down there would be a great way to sort of demonstrate the problems of segregation. And there was a Lebanese and Syrian and Palestinian community that had been there since the founding of Birmingham. So I thought it was sort of a great way just to show both what America and America were like in a really tangible way before these legislative changes.
And you frame the stories around other specific mm-hmm. events as well, issues in American history, the 1973 oil embargo, the 1995 Oklahoma City bombing. And we can understand why you've chosen those.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think those are events that, unfortunately, the times that Arab Americans kind of enter, or Arabs or Muslims re-enter as Americans, you know, the consciousness here in the country is when these sorts of geopolitical events flare up. And at the same time, those events did have an impact on how the community saw themselves and how individuals saw themselves. So they're important from both angles.
Well, it wasn't just Arabs who were facing resentment from Americans. At the time of the oil embargo, we were seeing Asians being picked on because the feeling was that Japan was surpassing the United States. But in the case of Arabs, it was because of it wasn't because of jihadis. It was because of the feeling that that Saudi Arabia was and other Arab oil producing countries were destroying our economy.
Yeah, I think specifically in 73, that was the idea, even though the United States was heading into an energy crisis before.
And OPEC is not totally an Arab organization.
I mean, I think part of it is because you sort of have to understand that after 1948, with the founding of the State of Israel, there was definitely an identification with that narrative and the finding of a Jewish homeland. And, you know, I think there wasn't really an understanding on the other side of the Palestinian narrative. And I think everybody sort of – most Arabs in the American imagination came to be implicated by how we understood the Palestinian situation.
You tell the story of September 11th through the eyes of a Lebanese-born Christian priest in Brooklyn Heights. And that chapter ends with an amazing discovery at Ground Zero.
Mm-hmm. You want me to give it away?
Yeah, sure.
Well,
we're not going to give away all of the secrets of this book.
But in the rubble at the World Trade Center a few months later, and there are several parishioners who die from this, because this is a church in Brooklyn Heights, and this church loses several parishioners. And then a couple months later, while they're clearing the rubble down at Ground Zero, they find the cornerstone of the original church from which the Brooklyn colony was sort of founded from. And, you know, that cornerstone was laid a very, very long time ago. And it was a really sort of compelling way to make the point that the, you know, destinies of America and America have been intertwined for quite a long time.
I was struck by the story of Omar Dejani, whose father is Palestinian, but he grew up in the heart of Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered whether he self-identifies more as a Texan or a Palestinian.
Today or then? You know, I would say he's a Palestinian American. I think then he just desperately wanted to be in the camp of Texan. But there were several things, from his, you know, curly hair to his hairy legs to his darker skin, that kept him from fitting in the part of Texas where he lived, which was a particularly white and Southern Baptist place.
Well, not everyone wants to assimilate. One of the inspirations for anti-American Arabs is Sayyid Kutb, an Egyptian who came to America, was totally disillusioned by our way of life. Has that been the experience of other immigrants from Arab countries? Because the culture is so different.
You know, it's several million individuals. And I think the fact that most people sort of stay here and do well and have meaningful lives here, you know, is probably
There's always the tension between assimilation and maintaining the culture of the old country.
Yeah, I think that's true. But I think the story of America is one of integration. I prefer to talk about integration more than assimilation. This idea, it's sort of a two-way process where, you know, there's an impact upon the people who've come here, and they also impact our culture here, which is dynamic. I mean, culture is not a static thing, and it's constantly changing and moving.
You wrote this book before we saw things like political candidates saying mm-hmm. that there are two cities in America that are ruled by Sharia law, and she might very well wind up in the Senate, Sharon Angle. Are things getting worse and worse for Arab Americans?
Well, I think, you know, I think there was an opportunity after 9/11 and to sort of get to know these people who have been part of this country as long as other groups that we easily consider as Americans have been part of this country. And I think a lot of people did try to step into that void. And my book was definitely an effort to sort of be that kind of an intervention. But you know, I don't think there was enough of that. I think we still sort of only look at the reality is Arab Americans as Americans and Muslim Americans as Americans remain somewhat invisible, whereas at the same time you have this hyper visibility of Arabs and Muslims from, you know, quote unquote over there. And, you know, we had this void that was painfully obvious after 9/11 that, you know, I don't think there have been enough efforts to really fill it. And in that time, since then, we've had two wars in Muslim or Arab countries. We've had, you know, continued things happening without that sort of context and history that would sort of help balance things out or help the picture be more realistic.
How did your parents end up coming from Syria to Baltimore?
Well, my mom ended up coming to Baltimore because she married my dad. My dad was a doctor, and he came and he did his residency at the University of Maryland.
Did they speak Arabic in the home?
They did, and since I'm the firstborn, I kind of got the most benefit of that. But then I corrupted that pretty quickly. I mean, I think a kindergartner who doesn't want to speak Arabic to corrupt that.
And was Syrian culture part of your upbringing?
You know, like I said, culture is fluid and dynamic. So 1969 Syria, which is the one my dad left, was the Syrian culture that we had. So it was, you know, it was definitely like a time capsule of some sort.
The reason I ask is some time back I had a man here who came out of – who has been living in the Syrian community in Queens for much of his life. But he says he will not eat any food that doesn't come out of that culture. He's sure that Chinese food is good. He's sure that the French food is good. But he's just going to stick to the food that he knows is the best.
Well, I mean, you know, he could do worse. Syrian food is delicious.
So what did you learn about yourself and your own background that you didn't know before you wrote this book?
Well, you know, I really didn't know a lot about that pre-1924 history. My parents came over after 65, after the liberalization of the American immigration law. You know, I think most people would be surprised to hear this, but the book starts on the football field in Birmingham, Alabama in 1948. So I didn't know that there were Arab American football players. I didn't know about that long and older history. And, you know, it was something I wish I knew about when I was growing up, because I was sort of always looking for some kind of affirmation that I belonged here.
There was a time when there were a fair number of Arabic speakers in the U.S. State Department. Mm-hmm. I read recently there's hardly mm-hmm. anybody today, which strikes me as rather odd, because we had a lot of people being encouraged to study Russian and Chinese in the past. Why do you think that situation still remains a serious problem?
Well, I mean, Arabic is a tough language, but I don't think, you know, I think for the longest time, and I don't know how much this has changed with the new administration, but I think for the longest time they didn't understand that being able to communicate with the people that you are trying to work with or make war with or trade with would, you know, probably be to your advantage. And the reality is many people in the Arab world do speak English.
Well, many people all around the world right. speak English, but that's not the same thing. If you want to have a serious right. conversation with somebody, it's a good idea to know the person's language.
I think the U.S. government has also been wary of recruiting the people who would be the most obvious people to fill those kinds of positions, like Arab Americans.
Because they're not sure that they can trust them.
Right. You know, and I think that goes back to a sort of over-identification with, you know, with Israeli interests as opposed to interests in the rest of the region.
How does that play in the Arab-American community?
You know, I think Arab-Americans have been incredibly resilient, and, you know, they still, at least the organized, formal associations that are, you know, I think they're always receptive to when an invitation is extended to them. But I think it's also sent a kind of message to a lot of folks that maybe these aren't the sorts of careers or fields that their contributions are going to be welcomed in.
Just one more thing. Sure. You've talked about Israel as an irritant, and I've always wondered about why Egyptians, for example, who have serious problems at home, people from Libya or Algeria, people from Syria, people from Lebanon, which has been ripped apart by its own sectarian violence. Why Israel is so central to their sense of outrage when there's so many other things for them to be outraged by?
You know, I think that's that's a multifaceted question. It's true, but sometimes it's easier to look to external factors. I don't think the people in the Middle East are unique in that way. It's sort of locating their problems externally as opposed to internally. And also, a lot of these regimes are repressive, so there isn't that much room to agitate against the government. But they know that there's a lever, like a sort of a safety valve, that they can exercise by channeling that kind of anger at not having.
But in this country as well.
I think actually you've seen people in this country be active on trying to lobby the U.S. government also to sort of end the repressive regimes in the Middle East. You know, the Israeli narrative, when I brought up the Israeli example, it was just more to sort of explain why there's a more of an identification with that narrative as opposed to, and that has in some way sort of precluded us from looking at maybe other narratives as well.
Alia Malik's has written for Salon, the Columbia Journalism Review, the New York Times, the online editions of the Washington Post, the Christian Science Monitor. She has written a book called A Country Called America, A-M-R-E-E-K-A, U.S. History Retold Through Arab American Lives, now made available in paperback from the Free Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.